Today is Wednesday, July 19th. We're going to be wrapping up brain, spinal cord, and autonomic nervous system information today. Okay, so on page 112, we're going to cover brain parts, and we're going to go through and apply what we learned on Monday from that brain picture to what each part does. Okay, so there are actually four regions of the brain. The first region is the one that we're all familiar with, the part that's the wrinkly portion of your brain. What is this big outer portion here called?
Cerebrum.
Good. And the region at the back of your brain, back here that controls, or about helps to control balance and movement, is
cerebellum.
Good. Inside the brain, we've got a couple of regions. We've got an area in here called the diencephalon. And then down below, toward the spinal cord, we have the brain stem. So let's talk about just in general for the cerebrum first. The cerebrum has four primary lobes, and they're associated with the parts of your skull. So in this color-coded picture, we can easily see the frontal lobe at the front of the brain. That's toward the anterior surface. Toward the posterior surface, we have the occipital lobe. What sense is housed in your occipital lobe?
Vision,
good. On the sides, we have temporal lobe. What sense is housed there?
Hearing,
good. And at the tops of each brain's or cerebral hemisphere, we do have a parietal lobe, and we're going to talk more about the somatic sensory cortex that's housed there. Okay, so in the brain, we've actually got white matter and gray matter, but they're reversed in their locations from the spinal cord. In the spinal cord, where was the white matter located? Outside, good. Notice for the brain, the white matter is on the inside portion, and this time the gray matter is on the outer portion. So we do have more surface area created by the convolutions or those hills and valleys in the gray matter. We talked already about the gyri and sulci that make up the brain's surface features. So the cortex, or outer 1/8 inch of your brain surface, has these hills and valleys to increase surface area. So where would you find a sulcus? Is it a raised hill or a valley?
Valley.
Good. And of course, a gyrus is a raised hill. What is the difference between a sulcus and a fissure?
Fissure splits the brain into parts.
Good. Fissures split the brain into parts, so it's a much deeper groove than a sulcus would be. Okay. So in terms of gray matter there on your worksheet, we're going to look at various types of tracts. We did the gray matter. We're going to look at white tracts here inside the brain. These tracts are pathways that help speed information from one region of the brain to the other. So you're going to find that we've got three types of fibers here: association, commissural, and projection fibers that speed information from one location to the next. So let's talk about association fibers first. Association fibers run the length of your brain from anterior to posterior. So in this picture of the left hemisphere, they actually transmit information along the length of that cerebral hemisphere. So you may have heard the joke that people have eyes in the backs of their head, especially moms. So the vision that you interpret at your occipital lobe is actually carried there by way of an association fiber. Down below, you'll notice that there are commissural fibers that connect the two hemispheres together. When we studied the spinal cord, there is a piece of tissue called the gray commissure. What was its job? One side to the other. Good. That is the same job here. So when you hear the word commissural fiber, it performs the same function as your gray commissure. So yeah, these fibers carry information from the left hemisphere to the right and vice versa. There have actually been studies done in psychology where they cut these corpus callosum or the commissural fibers. These fibers, of course, connect the left and right hemispheres. And in those studies, they've had people close one eye or the other, and the person can identify keys laying on the table, but they can't say the word for those keys. So kind of interesting.
Split brain operation.
Split brain operation, exactly. So pretty cool stuff that comes from accidents that happen. They actually do these split brain operations nowadays for things like seizures, but nonetheless, that's kind of how we discovered what the function of those commissural fibers was going to be. Let's see, our last fiber tract is a type of white matter that travels from the spinal cord up through the thalamus and radiates out to the brain's cerebral cortex. They are called projection fibers. So in this bottom picture, this big bulb right here is the thalamus. And its job is to be what?
The sensation relay.
Good. It's a relay for sensory info. So sensory information that travels up your spinal cord, like, say, pain or temperature info, will hit these projection fibers after traveling through the thalamus, and it's then transmitted to the right portion of your cerebral cortex. So these tracts, I want to emphasize, the word tract implies white matter, and it implies that we're dealing with a portion of your central nervous system, not PNS. Okay, and they're kind of like speed pathways. They carry information more quickly to their destinations. How about questions on page 112? I think the easiest way to learn page 113 is to sit with a picture of the brain, whether it's one you drew and labeled or whether it's one from the PowerPoint, and point and talk yourself through the pictures. Trying to read through the chart without a visual is a little more clunky way to learn it. You can flashcard this information, but yeah, having a picture or something in front of you to look at, I think really makes this stuff click. So what I'm going to do is start you off with the cerebral portions of your brain that have certain responsibilities. And at the very top of your page, you notice our first responsibility for the cerebrum is motor control. All right, so motor control is often described as either voluntary or subconscious. So let's take the voluntary motor control first. Going back to what we learned in here on Monday, there's a groove that separates your frontal lobe from your parietal lobe. What's the name of that groove?
Central sulcus.
Central sulcus, good. The piece of tissue that's a heel in front of that groove is called precentral what?
Gyrus.
Gyrus, good. So that precentral gyrus is home to a portion of your brain that serves in motor control. So if you decide to pick up your pen and write right now, then that precentral gyrus is going to initiate that motor control. So we think of that area as being a primary motor cortex. What does primary mean?
It's first.
First, yeah. So when you think about moving your body, that is the first place the thoughts are initiated. So that precentral gyrus is probably easier seen in this picture. This motor cortex right through here is going to map to a portion of your body and control its movement through conscious, voluntary thought. Really cool thing about that precentral gyrus, it is mapped in what we call a motor homunculus. And this homunculus is pictured as you see here. There's a lot of devotion to the movement of your face. There's a lot of devotion to the movement of your hands and some to your feet. But you'll notice that your elbows, your other joints like your knees and shoulders, they don't get a whole lot of surface area for the brain. Why not? What does your elbow do? One movement, you're right. Flex, extend, flex, extend. So you don't need a whole lot of surface area for a body part that does just flexion and extension. Same thing with your knee. It does the very same. It flexes and extends. So we don't need a whole lot of surface area for such a simplistic action. But, you know, you think about all the detail work your fingers and hands can do, and same thing with your face. No wonder those areas get a lot more surface area. So this motor homunculus sits in the primary motor cortex. In which lobe of your brain is it located?
Frontal.
Frontal, good. And very specifically, what part of your frontal lobe houses the primary motor cortex?
The precentral gyrus.
Precentral gyrus, good. I wanted to tie this together for you. Monday we talked a little bit about descending tracts. What kind of information is housed in the descending tract of the spinal cord? Motor, good. So when you decide to pick up your pen and write or to move any part of your body consciously and voluntarily, that information travels from your cerebral cortex down a descending tract. We do cross the gray commissure. We pop out that ventral horn of gray matter, and here we go with the message out our ventral root of the spinal nerve. So the process that we learned in here on Monday of using the spinal cord is now linked to what your brain is doing. So now we get the whole big picture of how this operates together as a whole. Let's see, we've got subconscious motor control, which is next. It is a type of control that's housed in your basal nuclei. And if you look inside the brain here, don't these things look like eyeballs? Right there and right there. So just happens to be that those little pockets of gray matter look like eyeballs. They have nothing to do with vision, though. Their job is to help you regulate subconscious motor control. So you may notice that when you walk, your arms swing with your gait, and that motion of your arms is linked to those basal nuclei. We know that there is a neurotransmitter called dopamine that helps you to regulate motion. So if people have dopamine issues, as is the case with Parkinson's disease, they no longer swing their arms as they're supposed to. Ever seen someone with Parkinson's disease try to walk? Okay, arms are hanging and they shuffle, and their arms no longer move at that routine gait that we expect to see. So that's kind of a clue for what those basal nuclei do and their role as a subconscious motor control. Okay, so let's review. So far, we've got the primary motor cortex in which lobe?
Frontal
lobe. In what specific gyrus?
Precentral.
Precentral, good. Is this primary motor cortex responsible for voluntary or involuntary motor control?
Voluntary,
good. And where do you house subconscious motor control?
Basal
nuclei, good. And of course, that's things like swinging your arms when you walk. Let's now switch gears and talk about sensory input. And so we're going to look first toward the somatic sensory area. So looking at our brain picture one more time, let's go back to this one here. It's a little bit easier to see. In this picture, you'll notice a somatosensory region right here on the back side of that central gyrus. This raised hill of tissue is known as what?
Postcentral
gyrus, good. What lobe are we sitting in?
Parietal,
good. What does somatic sensory mean? What are we feeling?
Sensations.
Yeah, sensations, good. So whether it's touch or pressure or, you know, things that come through your skin, these are what we think of as somatic sensory information. So if you put your hand in your pocket and you feel keys or you feel coins, those kinds of sensation are linked to what we think of as somatic sensory. To clarify, I would say that somatic sensory has nothing to do with vision, hearing, balance. Okay, those are all coming from your head. So that somatic sensory cortex in your postcentral gyrus also has a homunculus. And this little map, again, gives a lot of devotion to your face, your hands, your feet. You do have a lot of sensation or sensory neurons there. You have less so in the other regions, such as in your joints and regions like, say, your upper arm or upper leg. Okay, so I want to clarify there's two terms here on your worksheet. There is a primary and then there's a secondary. So looking at your sensory areas, you'll oftentimes see a primary versus an association area for several of these listed. The primary area is, guess what? The first area that your brain receives that information. Okay, primary means first. So anytime you hear about a primary sensory area, that is the first portion of your brain tissue to receive that information. You may notice some of these sensory areas do list an association area. Association areas get the information second. And it is the association's job to make sense of what you've just experienced. Okay. So let's kind of go back and talk about what we've discussed before. What you feel travels up your spinal cord. That information is relayed through your thalamus, and your thalamus sends the information by way of projection fibers out to the right region of your brain. So if you've touched something that's slimy and cold, then that information, of course, travels here to the hand region. So the primary somatic sensory cortex is just going to receive that information. Where you make sense of it is right next door in an area that we call the association area. So they've actually mapped it out right here. There's your association area. It sits right next door to that primary somatic sensory cortex. So when you feel that and you say, oh, wow, that's slimy and cold, then your brain starts to make sense of what you've just experienced. And so other areas of your brain put this together and say, what is it? You know, is it a snake? Is it, you know, some kind of gel? You know, what have I just touched? So the association area is where the processing goes on. The primary area is just where you receive that information. Something interesting about this, you know, you're pre-mapped with body parts, whether or not you're born with them or not. And in the 1960s, there was a drug that was used in Europe called thalidomide. And people thought that it might be great for morning sickness for moms that are pregnant. And unfortunately, it really didn't do the job that it was supposed to do. And instead, it did something far worse. It caused major birth defects, like you can see in this picture. The people that had, moms that had taken thalidomide as a drug to prevent morning sickness, had babies that were born with arms and legs that were actually non-existent. They had little pieces of hands that were stuck to their shoulders, and they had little feet parts that were stuck here to their legs. You can see what almost looks like a hand down there, but that's all there is of the leg and the foot. Interesting thing about this, though, even though they were born with completely malformed body parts, their primary somatic sensory cortex was still mapped to the body parts as if they existed completely normally. So the brain was wired for those body parts even without them forming. So later in life, if somebody has an amputation with normal body parts, then that amputation doesn't necessarily rewire the brain because the brain is still wired to receive all that incoming information. So kind of interesting, we're already set up for our entire complete bodies, whether or not we form that way. Okay, so let's talk about the visual area. What lobe of your brain houses vision?
Occipital lobe.
Occipital lobe, good. The simple act of seeing is housed in the primary or the association area?
Association.
Just being able to see?
Primary.
Primary, good. Making sense of what you see? That's the association area, right. Okay, so somebody who has a stroke in the primary visual cortex cannot do what?
See.
Cannot see. Good. Somebody who has a stroke in the association area for the visual cortex
cannot make sense of what they see.
Yeah, they can still see, they just can't make sense of what they see. So if there's brain damage, they may not recognize the person that they're familiar with. They may not recognize their house or other things that used to be familiar. Some interesting stuff at work out there. There is actually some fancy sets of glasses that people can wear who may have problems with their visual cortexes. And these glasses actually help to bring visual information around and bypass the eyes and take the visuals directly into the brain. So there was something on TV a few years ago about this. They had taken these special glasses and hooked them up for people that had vision problems. They took a man in his 40s who was blind from birth and gave him these glasses. They hooked them back there into the primary visual cortex. They also gave these glasses to a woman in her 20s who had lost her sight due to disease at age 3. So she had 3 years of being able to see. Who do you think was most excited to continue the experiments with the glasses?
The person who could see.
Yeah. So the girl who could see up until age 3 and lost her vision at that point was most excited because what had already developed in her brain?
The primary and the association area.
So her brain had already started to figure out what do I do with all these images that come back here. We do a lot of pruning. You know, we screen out what we don't want to see. So we ignore stuff that's unnecessary and unimportant. I mean, how many times has something been sitting right in front of you and you neglect to see it, right? So we do a lot of visual pruning because there is a lot of busy visual clutter in our environments. The man in his 40s said, no, thank you. Don't want these things. Take them back. What had not developed in his brain? Yeah, those association areas. So his brain was unable at that point to really make sense of what was being shown to him. Okay, so our next major piece of the brain tissue is in the temporal lobe. What sensation is housed here?
Auditory.
Auditory, good. So like we've been studying, things are contralaterally controlled. So, for instance, vision from your right eye is taken to your left hemisphere occipital lobe. Hearing from your right ear travels to your left temporal lobe. Good. So all this is still contralateral control. What type of fiber takes information left and right?
Commissural
fibers. Good. So that's how information gets across from one hemisphere to the other. Likewise, there is an auditory association area in addition to a primary auditory cortex. Which of those two is the first one to receive sound?
Primary.
Good. And where do you make sense of hearing?
Auditory
association area. Good. If someone is hit in the head by a baseball and it damages the primary auditory cortex, the concern is for that person to be
deaf.
Yep. If the damage is done in the association area, now the concern is can't understand what you're hearing. Right. So they can hear, but they may not be able to make sense of what is being heard. Good. All right. So we've got then smell, which is olfaction, and taste, which is gustation. You would think they would be in the same lobe because they're so closely linked, but in fact, they're not. So you'll notice on your worksheet there that smell is housed in the temporal lobe, along with hearing, right? So smell and hearing go together? That doesn't seem right, but it does. Okay, so those two go together. And then taste is found in which lobe? Parietal lobe. So taste and touch actually go in the same lobe together. So oddly enough, taste and smell are not in the same lobe, but they do sit really closely nearby each other. So let's just go back through and review where we've studied this stuff. Where is vision housed?
Occipital lobe.
Good. And hearing?
Temporal lobe.
And touch?
Parietal lobe.
Good. And voluntary motor control?
Frontal.
Good. Okay. Down near the bottom of your page, there is something called general interpretation. And for most of us, we have an area on our left hemisphere. Oddly enough, on the left hemisphere, that is the home for where we accumulate all of these sensations and we put them together for general interpretation. So we don't live by one sense alone. We take in the world around us through vision and hearing and smell, taste, touch. All of that ends up being sent here to this region, kind of over the temporal, parietal, and occipital lobes junction. That is where we put together and kind of make an assimilation of what's happening in the world around us. Also, for most of us in the left hemisphere, is a speech center, and speech is in more than one location. This just happens to be the primary place for it. You'll notice that it's sitting right here, okay? Happens to be close to that temporal lobe where hearing is formed. So speech centers are for most of us in the left hemisphere. Oddly enough, if you talk on the telephone and you're right-handed, which phone or which ear do you put the phone to? How many of you are right-handed and use your right ear? Just curious. How many of you are right-handed and use your left ear? Interesting. How many of you are left-handed and use your right ear? Anybody left-handed? What ear do you use? So you're more comfortable over there. Okay. So what they think is, if you prefer one ear for the telephone over the other, then the speech hemisphere or the speech center is in the opposite hemisphere. So if you're right-handed and you use your right ear, your speech center is in your left hemisphere. If you're left-handed and you're using your left ear, her speech center is in her right hemisphere. Yeah. So if you're one of those that uses both back and forth, I don't know about that, right? Use back and forth. So yeah, they say that for most of us, it's left. Some of us train our brains to hear and do speech out of both sides. But for a lot of us, we train our brains to hear out of one ear and send that information to the opposite hemisphere. So it would be cool to do a brain scan and see where those speech hemispheres are located for those of us who use both sides of our head for the telephone. Who talks on the telephone anyway, right? Everybody text. Okay, and we talked about prefrontal cortex on Monday. What is housed there?
The front of the
Decisions, yeah. Personality, decisions, toilet training.
Planning ahead.
So this prefrontal cortex in the frontal lobe is what makes you you. It is where your personality is housed. I can talk today. Mm-hmm. It is your decorum, toilet training, planning, personality. So, you know, this is where we really think of us as being us. If that part is damaged, then we do lose the ability to make plans, to, you know, say what we're supposed to say and not say what we're not supposed to say. So damage to that prefrontal cortex is certainly something that's been well traced since about the 1850s. This man, Phineas Gage, had a railroad tie blow through his head and lived to tell about it. Amazing, look what damage it did to his skull there. And you can see it completely blocked out. I'm surprised he even has hair left on that side of his head after having a pipe blow through that side.
It went straight through, completely took out his whole prefrontal cortex, but he was still able to tell about it. Oh my God. And like the whole story about it, he wasn't able to recognize most things before, unless it were before the accident. He didn't even have any way of knowing how to plan out his day. And he used to be a manager of the railroad. They had to demote him because he couldn't even govern other people, let alone himself.
Which was really sad after where he had been, yeah. What do you think happened to his personality after the accident? Yeah, big change, yeah. What I've read about him, it says that he was like an easygoing guy, like he said, a manager there, mm-hmm. and he became very angry later in life. As you can imagine, having half your brain blown out would make you very angry, but it's not just that, it's actually where the brain was damaged. It was that prefrontal cortex. So that is the catch for what happened to him.
And he was more so impulsive like a child, mostly.
That would make sense, yeah.
Like, when they say that he was angry, it was only because he couldn't understand what was going on. And so he would come at it like how he would as a child.
So he'd lost that maturity that had come from that prefrontal cortex, yeah. Interesting thing about that prefrontal cortex, they say it takes until around age 25 to fully develop that prefrontal cortex. So that's a long time that prefrontal cortex is in development. Go ahead.
So did he have issues with toilet training also?
I don't know about in his particular case. Did he?
Yeah.
I can imagine. You know, we talked about prefrontal lobotomies, you know, a little bit in here on Monday. If they do a prefrontal lobotomy, they actually damage that prefrontal cortex. So it does revert you kind of back to a childlike state. So you can imagine what that would do if you take something akin to an ice pick and damage all of that frontal lobe tissue.
I know someone who has damaged their prefrontal cortex, and they have a hard time going on to, like, stop eating. Is that the same place that's damaged, or, like, what is damaged for that?
Eating is actually hypothalamus. It's the hunger portion of our brains. So I'm not sure what exactly...
So it's just probably more damaged than just...
Perhaps, maybe, yeah. But then everything is so tied together, so there may be something having to do with that prefrontal damage that affects other kinds of control. So it may be the control of knowing when to stop eating, knowing that sensation of feeling full is knowing when to stop. There may be more of that tied in than we realize.
But they have, like, mentality of a 12-year-old now.
Wow. That makes sense. Very bottom of your page there, just a little bit about hemisphere lateralization. The left and right hemispheres, we think, have different jobs. And we understand that the left hemisphere is where we house things like language, math, and logic. And the right hemisphere is for more of the art-type skills, spatial orientation, emotional side of our brain, the artistic side of our brain. And, of course, we don't live just by one side or the other. We engage both sides to do a task. But, you know, some of us do tend to do skills that favor one side more so than the other. Okay, so like I mentioned when we started this page, I think probably one of the better things to do is sit with a picture and go through that page instead of just simply trying to read it or memorize it. Sit with a picture of the brain and then point and tell what each part of those brain cerebral portions do. And page 114 is a practice page for you. We've done page 115. Do y'all have any questions on 115? Mm-hmm. Okay, let me bring you down page 116. To help you guys out, you'll notice that there are bold-faced terms, and then under the function, there is probably a bold-faced term or two. When you're studying this page, look for those bold-faced terms. For instance, the cerebellum functions in muscle coordination. Okay, so I'm hoping this will make this page a whole lot easier for you. Cerebellum, this piece at the back of the brain, functions in muscle coordination. It too has a little motor homunculus that goes to your body parts, mapped from your body parts. And unfortunately, if we're drunk, so is the cerebellum. We don't get proprioceptor information as we should. So unfortunately, that makes us a little more limber in our movements, not quite so balanced. Let's see. Let's talk about the diencephalon next. There's three portions here: hypothalamus, thalamus, and the pituitary gland. So inside the brain, let's look for those. We now have a corpus callosum that sits up here. Underneath, we have this region called the thalamus. Underneath it, hypo, of course, is hypothalamus, and they have cut the connection to the pituitary gland. That's the diencephalon. Down below, we've actually got brainstem, which includes midbrain right here. We have the pons, and below that would be the medulla oblongata, and those, of course, sit in the lower brainstem. I know you probably think I'm crazy, but I'm going to tell you there's a duck in your brain. And if you look at it, you see the duck's beak, you see the duck's head, the duck's got a big crown sitting on top. Here is the duck's chest, and we're going to have a fun duck that wears a backpack, and that cerebellum back there could be the backpack. So if you kind of look at it as a duck, it makes it a little more fun in memorizing all those parts inside the brain.
Yeah, I was told it was the Elvis rooster.
Oh, that's a cool way to look at it, yeah. So let's hit the hypothalamus first. The hypothalamus is going to be your homeostatic control portion of your brain, and its major jobs include all of these homeostatic mechanisms. Everything from controlling your body temperature to thirst, food intake, and hunger. We also regulate the sleep cycle here, your endocrine system, and your autonomic nervous system. So this is a big portion of your brain that really controls your survival needs. Okay, so to survive, you've got to have your hypothalamus working properly. Interesting stuff, some drugs like ecstasy actually can reset the body temperature higher than 98.6, or whatever your personal temperature is set at. The problem is, if you reset the body temperature to something like 106 or 108, you can denature the body's proteins and literally cook the body like a piece of meat. So that can cause death, especially if the body temperature sits near 108 for an extended period of time. So there's nothing ecstatic about this drug in terms of your body temperature. Let's see, the pituitary gland, let's get to that one since it is closely linked to your hypothalamus. What is the major job of your pituitary?
Send out hormones for the endocrine system.
Good, hormones for the endocrine system. So you'll notice that is linked back to the hypothalamus's function. Pituitary is our master endocrine gland. It is the one that controls a lot of your body with hormone function. We've been here before with the thalamus. We know its major job is to serve as a relay station for sensory input. Let's be specific. What type of sensory information comes up our spinal cord and through the thalamus? Pain and temperature. Yeah, so two good things. Pain is not good, but temperature is good to know about to come up through our spinal cord to our thalamus. So cool things about your thalamus. This is the part of your brain that keeps you awake. When you're getting sleepy, your thalamus is no longer relaying sensory information up to your brain. When it stops relaying information, you go to sleep. So interesting that your thalamus is responsible for keeping you awake and alert. So when it goes to sleep, you go to sleep. When it's awake and functional, you're awake and functional. So that's just how the relay station tends to work. If it stayed on all the time, so would we. Okay, so let's link the thalamus back to what we've covered earlier. If you have put your hand on a hot stove, you're going to feel the pain and temperature from that hot stove. That information travels in through a spinal nerve, through which route?
The
Dorsal root, good. We come up an ascending tract. Which particular tract takes you to the thalamus? You got it. Spinothalamic, that's it.
Well, yeah, now I understand the name, because it's going up the spinal cord to the thalamus.
Exactly right, good. And that's where we're going to go. We're going to hop across that gray commissure. That's what they're showing us there. We stop through the thalamus. It relays us out to the cerebral cortex. And if you put your hand on a hot stove, which lobe of the brain are we heading to?
Parietal.
Parietal, good. And what particular region?
Postcentral.
Postcentral, good. And that's our primary somatic sensory cortex. So, you know, we talked about there being a slight delay. You know, you put your hand on a hot stove, you jerk your hand away through a reflex, and then you go, oh man, that's going to hurt. And a split second later, you feel the pain. That's because it's traveling up that spinal cord through your thalamus and then being relayed out. So there's a little delay there in getting the message to the brain. All right, so let's see. We've got pituitary gland covered. Let's talk brainstem near the bottom. Brainstem is a lower portion connected to your spinal cord. So here we have the pons. Down below we have medulla oblongata. And hard to see in this picture, these little pieces back here are part of the midbrain. So we've got the corpora quadrigemina sitting back here close to your cerebellum. Let's talk about the medulla oblongata first. This is going to be something we routinely use in Bio-211. It is home to a number of control centers: heart rate, breathing, blood pressure, and vomiting. And since it has to monitor your blood pressure, this particular portion of your brain, like the hypothalamus, has no blood-brain barrier. So that means that blood can contact directly to your medulla, and if you've got poison in your blood from, say, something you ate, you're going to vomit, and that's very important for us to get that out of our systems. What's the major function of your pons?
Breathing.
Good. So pons is also involved in breathing. And this weird-looking picture has the midbrain. So on the back side here, you've actually got the corpora quadrigemina right here in this green area. So those little four bumps are actually part of the midbrain. The midbrain's involved in reflex control. What you see and what your ear senses through equilibrium is actually routed through that midbrain. So if you're on a boat, and the boat's going up and down, and your visual does not match your equilibrium, then of course we get sick. So there's the midbrain to help us coordinate what we see versus what we feel in terms of balance. Eyes and ears, that kind of reflex situation, blinking, you know, moving your eyes and tracking when you're walking is also routed through your midbrain. So if you spot the pencil sharpener and you spin around in a circle and you keep your eyes fixed on the pencil sharpener, then of course that's the midbrain helping your eyes stay locked in a certain position. There's a reflex involved in things like that. So midbrain is really a reflex-driven portion of your brainstem. It does link together eye and ear information. All right, so that should do it for this page.
Question.
Sure.
Is the oculomotor on the midbrain? Around the region of the midbrain?
Let's see. It's on the front side, it looks like, a little bit. Yeah, because we're looking mostly at those four bumps on the back side, but it does work through that area because we're getting eye movement linked into the midbrain. Yeah.
That analogy that you gave with the boat, that's actually one of the sensory functions of the oculomotor. Mm-hmm. That's why I was asking.
Okay. Just a little bit left for this stuff. On page 117 is limbic system and reticular activating system. So cool stuff here on the top of page 117. Let's do your limbic system first. This portion of your brain here is an old portion of your brain. What we're looking at is an area near your thalamus and hypothalamus. These are portions we haven't yet discussed. There's an area below your hypothalamus called the amygdala, and it kind of wraps around here. And there's another portion below that called the hippocampus, and it wraps all the way around your corpus callosum. So this particular portion of your brain is involved in memory formation. It's involved in emotional responses. If you had something tragic happen, something really happy happen, something memorable happen, then those kinds of inputs are going to be basically seared into your memory through this limbic system. So people who experience something that's really emotional oftentimes have it, you know, you can remember every detail of that particular event that's coming through this limbic system. Interesting thing, all of our senses are routed through your thalamus with the exception of smell. Smell is hardwired into your limbic system. So if you smell something 10, 20 years later that was a familiar smell to you, you go, oh, I know where I've smelled that before. It might be the perfume of a beloved relative, like a grandmother. It might be somebody's cigarette smoke. Maybe somebody smoked in their home and you have that particular odor singed into your memory. So those kinds of things like smell are also hardwired into this limbic system. So if you've ever had a gut response to respond emotionally to an event, like if something made you fly angry, and you think, boy, I didn't have to get so mad about that, or you just feel like it was a gut response to something, thank you, that's limbic system. So it doesn't think, it reacts. So, you know, that's how we're trained to be. We're trained to be reactive. That's what protects us. It's our self-preservation. So this is an old, old part of our brain. It's self-preservation, helps us make memories. Okay, and so our last system here is called the reticular activating system. It involves your relay station. What was your relay station?
Your thalamus.
Thalamus, good. So your thalamus is the one that sends appropriate information up to the cerebral cortex. And if it shuts off, of course, there's no information that's being sent. So this largely involves the thalamus, and it's a reticular formation situated around that thalamus. And some cool stuff about this one. If people undergo hypnosis, then they are more likely to receive subliminal messages such as, you know, stop eating, stop smoking, stop one habit or another. So what are we doing to the thalamus if we put somebody under hypnosis? Are you letting it be a screening mechanism anymore? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're letting it more allow more information to travel up through your thalamus and out to your cerebral cortex. So it is screening what it sends forward, such as the fact that you're wearing clothes. I know that all of you know you have clothes on, but you don't not consciously think about it. So that kind of information is being routed and or screened by your thalamus. LSD is a drug that helps to open up the gateways of your thalamus. More information, more sensory input can travel through to your brain if you kind of tell the thalamus, hey, look the other way. We're going to let all this information flood through to your brain. So people on LSD may see things like lots of colors. They see, you know, much more visual stimulation. Everything seems to be a much more heightened visual experience thanks to that thalamus being a little less attentive to screening what comes through. So pretty cool part of your brain. How about questions so far on 116 or 117? So the biggie of this chapter is that chart on page 112 and being able to identify those parts on the brain. 118 is just a read-at-home page. Okay, so it's just an FYI page, just a read-at-home page.
What about 114?
114 is a practice page for 113. Yeah, 112, 113 are your two big ones. Right, so we're going to transition a little bit. We're going to move into a slightly different topic that's found on page 120. Well, we spent quite a bit of time over the last couple of class periods discussing brain and spinal cord. Now we're going to transition to talking about the branches of your motor division, this autonomic division and this somatic division. Okay, so top of page 120 there, we're going to start by focusing on autonomic and somatic nervous systems. Just to start off with, which one of these nervous system controls involuntary events?
Autonomic,
good. So what are some involuntary events that occur in your body?
Breathing, heart rate, digestion.
Good, good. So breathing, heart rate, digestion. We're looking at things like smooth muscle activity, cardiac muscle activity, but not skeletal muscle activity. So which branch of motor control instead covers skeletal muscle function?
Somatic,
good. So we know somatic nervous system controls voluntary events like skeletal muscle activities, whereas autonomic nervous system controls involuntary events such as glands, smooth muscles, cardiac muscle activity. Okay, so we're going to take a trip down through autonomic nervous system. This particular system has two motor control pathways, parasympathetic and sympathetic. Let me repeat, these are all motor control pathways. Autonomic and somatic are ways to control your muscles. Okay, so we're looking at somatic being a voluntary motor control pathway. The autonomic pathway is an involuntary motor control pathway. Okay, so we're done with sensation for right now. We'll put that on the back burner. Right now we're focusing on motor control. So let's compare the somatic nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. We've already established the first two things. We know that somatic is controlling voluntary events. We also know that this involves skeletal muscle activity. So what are some things that can be controlled through the autonomic nervous system?
Involuntary
motor, good.
Hiccups,
yeah. Irritation to your phrenic nerve and that cervical plexus, yeah. So we've got things like breathing, digestion, urine formation and flow. Those things that you have no control over are all controlled through that autonomic motor pathway. Interesting to note that your somatic nervous system is faster, your autonomic is slower. I mean, if you want your muscles to move, you don't have 5 to 10 seconds to wait till you pick up a pen. You know, that would take forever, right? So somatic nervous system is fast. It uses a transmitter that we've already learned about called acetylcholine. And it uses a one neuron system. That's why it happens to be a faster system. And I'll show you a picture of that in just a moment. We know the skeletal muscles are ultimately controlled by your somatic nervous system. They are housed in the primary motor cortex. What lobe of your cerebrum?
Frontal lobe,
good. And the specific piece of nervous tissue?
Precentral gyrus,
good. By contrast, the autonomic nervous system is slow. It uses multiple neurotransmitters. It's what we call a two-neuron system, and I'll show you that. And it's controlled by your hypothalamus. So what are some other functions of your hypothalamus?
Thirst, hunger.
Sleep-wake cycle. Good. Anything that maintains homeostasis. Good. So we're looking at the autonomic nervous system being involuntary, something that you can't control, and that's routing through your hypothalamus. Before we head into the next set of material here, there's some questions at the bottom of your page. Let me let you read through those questions and see if there's anything there that we need to go into detail with. So let's take number one. A nerve is in the PNS. Where's a tract?
CNS.
Yep, CNS, good. So a nerve is in the PNS. A tract is in the CNS. Let's see number two there. A ganglion is in the PNS. What is a ganglion?
Group of nerves,
good. Ganglion is a group of nerves. It is in the PNS. Lateral horn versus dorsal horn. Yeah, well, ventral horn. I'm not even reading it correctly. I can't read today, apparently. Lateral horn versus ventral horn.
Lateral horn has visceral motor
and ventral horn has somatic motor.
Good, awesome. Okay, so lateral horn, visceral motor.
Ventral horn has the somatic.
Good, ventral horn has somatic motor. Good. How about number four, sensory and motor information?
Sensory is the things that you can detect and sense of.
And they go toward the
brain.
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 Yeah, and motor comes from the
spinal.
Yeah, brain and spinal cord. Good. So you could say that sensory is what you detect. You send sensory to your central nervous system, or CNS. Motor is, of course, coming from your central nervous system. Okay, and then related to those terms, efferent with an E, afferent with an A, are just other terms for sensory and motor. Which one of those means toward the central nervous system? Afferent, yeah, with an A, yeah.
So that would be,
yeah, afferent with an A is sensory.
Efferent
is away from, that's right. How about any of the rest of those questions? Any of those want to go over? You're probably good with voluntary and involuntary, right?
Mm-hmm.
White matter, gray matter. Any questions on those? Okay. And we're in the midst of talking about automatic versus, or autonomic versus somatic. Let's see, acetylcholine, what's the role there?
Muscle relaxation.
Yep. Excite those muscles. We know about synapses, and we're going to talk more about visceral and somatic motor control in just a moment. Why don't we do a break, and we're going to pick up with page 121 in just about 5 minutes or so. Why don't we come back about 9 or 9:02? Okay, so we're on page 121. Do you guys have any questions so far on anything we've covered from the brain? Okay, on page 121, we're going to start talking about the autonomic nervous system pathway. And I've got a picture about halfway down the page for you that looks something like this. So, tell me what you recognize about this picture.
Spinal cord,
good, okay. And we have a neuron coming from a particular portion of your spinal cord. Lateral horn, good. What type of neurons are housed in the lateral horn?
Motor neurons.
Motor neurons, good. Are they visceral that control involuntary events, or are they somatic?
They're visceral.
They're visceral. Good. So that's something to notice about this picture. We're talking about the autonomic nervous system's control of involuntary motor events. So we've got a neuron coming from the lateral horn. It travels out that ventral root, and it heads over here to something that looks like a circle. That circle represents a ganglion. So what is a ganglion? Group of nerves, good. Are ganglion found in the CNS or in the PNS?
PNS,
good. So the neuron heading to the ganglion, we should label as a preganglionic neuron. That is a preganglionic neuron. In fact, that is the cell body housed here in the lateral horn. The axon travels out the ventral root, And these are axon terminals that are inside of that ganglion. Since we know a ganglion is in fact a group of neurons, this ganglion may have hundreds or even more of those neurons all collected there together. We actually call this a two-neuron system, which is kind of a lie in a way. There are a preganglionic and a postganglionic neuron setup, but of course there's perhaps many hundreds of neurons in that ganglion in between the pre- and postganglionic neurons. This neuron that picks up here with its cell body and axon terminals, this one is known as our postganglionic neuron. All right, so we've got three things to label here. We have a preganglionic neuron. This is the ganglion, the circle. And the neuron leading away is called your postganglionic neuron. So what types of events does the autonomic nervous system control?
Involuntary,
good. So things like smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, glands, organs. Obviously not voluntary movements here that we're controlling. Since we're talking about involuntary movements, we don't necessarily need a fast relay system to get the message to the destination. So we use what is called a two-neuron system. Your two neurons are the preganglionic neuron and the postganglionic neuron. And yet, this is a complete lie because there's hundreds of neurons situated between them in that ganglion right there. So the reason that this is a slower system is you have to synapse between every neuron before you eventually get over there to the destination, which in this case happens to be an organ like the pancreas. So when we think about the two systems and we compare them and we say ANS is a two-neuron system that happens to be slow, that's why we're having to relay a synapse, chemical message, every time we pass through another synapse. Okay. So the autonomic nervous system is two neurons. The somatic nervous system is how many neurons?
One.
Okay. So when you want to move your skeletal muscles, you don't want a delay. You want an immediate response to your skeletal muscles. So in this case, we have what's called a one-neuron system, and there is only one neuron. It starts here in your ventral horn of your gray matter. It travels out the ventral root, and you'll notice the axon terminals innervate that that skeletal muscle. So by having one neuron, then you have only one synapse, and that synapse is the one between your axon terminals here and that neighboring skeletal muscle cell. All right, so I want you to notice the difference. Where does the preganglionic neuron originate in the spinal cord here?
Lateral
horn, good. We don't have a ganglionic neuron here. We just simply have the one neuron. But where does it originate in your somatic nervous system?
Ventral.
Good. So that gives us an idea that we've got involuntary control on the lateral horn. What type of control in your ventral horn?
Somatic.
Voluntary. Good. Which is somatic. Just to make the point, do you see any ganglions in this picture for the somatic nervous system?
No.
No preganglionic, no postganglionic, no ganglion. So the fact that there's no ganglion here means you're automatically going to have a faster response by your skeletal muscles. Now, what neurotransmitter is released by your axon terminals onto that skeletal muscle?
Acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine, good. All right, so we're kind of laying the foundation here for these two systems. Do you have any questions so far about our pictures? Okay, fast forward you through that. So when you look at a picture like these, we're actually looking at somatic or autonomic nervous systems. We kind of have to decide which one we're dealing with. Let me flip you on over and talk to you about page 122. We are now going to talk about the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system divisions. That was our whole goal for today, is to get to this point. Okay, so let me remind you where we're at. We are under the motor breakdown. We're in a motor division. We've talked about somatic nervous system control of skeletal muscles. And we've talked about autonomic nervous system control of involuntary smooth muscles, cardiac muscle, glands, and organs. Well, we have two controlling and two battling systems here. They are called the sympathetic division and the parasympathetic division. They kind of work like a gas pedal and a brake pedal. They're doing opposite jobs. They are antagonistic to each other. So when we look at a picture like this, you'll notice that we have preganglionic neurons and postganglionic neurons. So automatically, that tells me this is a branch of which nervous system?
Autonomic,
yes. So pre and postganglionic neurons tell me this must be our autonomic nervous system. So can you control the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems?
You cannot.
You cannot, right? You might could influence them a little bit, but for the most part, you have no control over their activities. So let's talk about them. You ever been riding down the road, getting sleepy, driving the car, your eyes get heavy, and the next thing you know, you're either off into the ditch on the right side of the road or you're heading into oncoming traffic. Either way, you've got a problem, and immediately upon hearing horns blare at you, you're wide awake, right? You go from being completely asleep to completely alert. So which system here, sympathetic or parasympathetic, just kicked in?
Sympathetic
just kicked in, one. Right, so it's the one that will increase your activities and make you more alert. While you were sleepy, which system was dominating?
Parasympathetic,
good. So the sympathetic nervous system is called the fight or flight system. What does that mean?
It prepares you for physical activity, whether or not you're going to attack head on or run.
Good, good. So you're prepared one way or the other. Good. There are a couple of neurotransmitters that work for this system. Acetylcholine is one, but there's two others that work for this system. Do you know what they are?
Dopamine.
What's that?
Dopamine.
Epinephrine is one, and norepinephrine. Good. So how does epinephrine make you feel?
Good.
Why are you getting that? So epinephrine gives you an increased mental activity. It makes you more alert. It sends your metabolism into an increase. It also increases your heart rate and blood pressure. It dilates your respiratory passageways so you get more oxygen. It activates your energy reserves by breaking down fat into sugar. It turns on your sweat glands and deactivates or puts to rest your digestive and urinary functions. So, when you're driving down the road and you almost hit somebody head on because you're getting sleepy at the wheel, that sympathetic nervous system is the one that keeps you wide awake and prepared for what is to come. Okay, so on your sheet near the bottom of the page there's a little chart for us to look at. Let's take the sympathetic nervous system and follow it across. The origin of the fibers, we're talking preganglionic neurons here, they come from the thoracic and lumbar region of your spinal cord. You ever had a gut response to do something and you've got the physical strength to do it? You've probably heard of these stories where a car rolls over onto a child, mom comes along and picks up this 4,000-pound vehicle and moves the kid. And later on, she tries to pick up her car and she can't even get it to budge. That is the power of the sympathetic nervous system. So it's putting the reserves of your energy and your blood where it matters most, and that is into the gut region of your body. So your heart, your lungs get the blood, and that pumps out the energy, the oxygen to your muscles to make that work. So you'll notice in this picture, this is the thoracic lumbar region of your spinal cord, and of course that's going to have innervations to all of these vital organs. Which sets of vital organs are going to increase their activity during sympathetic control? Who increases activity? Heart and lungs, yeah. Sympathetic increases heart and lungs. Good. So thoracic cavity speeds up its activities. What do the organs in your abdominopelvic cavity do? Slow down. Yep. So speed up thoracic cavity organs, slow down your abdominopelvic cavity organs. In this picture, you may be able to see from where you're sitting that they have color-coded the preganglionic neuron versus the postganglionic neuron. The pre is red, and it's very close to your spinal cord, And then immediately we've got a black one that is a postganglionic neuron. So you'll notice that the ganglion, which is situated between your pre and your postganglionic neuron, actually sits closer to your spinal cord or the sympathetic nervous system. By contrast, with your parasympathetic nervous system, the ganglion actually sits very close to the organ and far away from your spinal cord. So kind of interesting, there's a difference in the way we're wired for these two systems. Let's see, we've also got the neurotransmitters. We've talked about those. Acetylcholine, epinephrine, and norepinephrine all work for your sympathetic nervous system. So what kinds of activities will force you into sympathetic control?
Anything where you're excited.
Good.
Like a car accident, anything that has to do with...
Events, right? So exercise puts you in a sympathetic mode. You're certainly alert when you're exercising. Nobody falls asleep while running, right? Okay. Excitement puts you into sympathetic mode. So does emergency and embarrassment. So it gets the epinephrine pushed through your veins, gets it into your bloodstream, and that way you stay excited for the duration of that, whatever that E term is. All right, so let's talk about parasympathetic nervous system for just a moment. The parasympathetic nervous system is known as your rest and digest system. What types of activities are favored by this system? Rest and digest? Yep, rest and digest. So favor your digestive organs, your urinary activities, and then put your heart and your lungs to rest. So your heart rate decreases, your blood pressure decreases, and instead we favor digesting food and making urine. So after a Thanksgiving meal, you know, people want to just take a long nap for the afternoon. That is the parasympathetic nervous system at work. People who have a nap after a meal, that is what's going on. Their body is favoring sending blood to their digestive organs and to favor that activity. All right, so now that we've talked about these two activities, let's talk about why they say not to go for a swim after a large meal. So let's take the large meal first. Where is blood going when you've had a large meal? Parasympathetic sends blood to your digestive organs. Good. Then you take this person who just ate a big meal, you throw them in the deep end of a pool, and you say, go for it. All right, so now where does the blood have to go? Sympathetic, which is heart and lungs, skeletal muscles, and we've got a battle that's set up. You've got about 5 liters of blood, and your body says, well, where do I send it? Do I send it to the food to be digested, or do I send it to the heart and lungs to keep you alive? Well, the battle is heart and lungs got to keep you alive, so that's where we send the blood. So that's why people get things like, you know, cramps in their muscles. They're not getting enough blood there because the blood is trying to go somewhat to your digestive organs. So kind of an interesting thing, there is some science behind that old myth of not going for a swim after you've had a large meal. So yeah, D words are favored by your parasympathetic nervous system, digestion, defecation, you know what that is? Okay, bowel movements, right? Diuresis is making urine, so these are all lower abdomen activities. Just to compare these, let's go back to our picture one more time. You'll notice that the cranial and sacral nerves serve the parasympathetic nervous system. So there is a very important cranial nerve that's involved in parasympathetic control. It is cranial nerve 10. What nerve is that?
Vagus,
good. And you know where it goes?
Visceral organs,
good. So heart and lungs, digestive organs. It is an unusual one because it wanders away from your cranium and it serves all these other organs. That vagus nerve releases acetylcholine. It tells your heart rate to slow down. It causes your digestive organs, however, to speed up their activity. So this is going to be a really big topic for Bio 211, is understanding the role of the vagus nerve in heart rate and understanding how it controls digestive function. Okay. So when they say mind over matter, this is what they mean. If you put yourself in parasympathetic control, you put your brain back in control as opposed to letting your gut do the talking, right? Because when you're in sympathetic mode, you're in emergency mode. When you're in parasympathetic mode, your brain is back in control. So you can think more clearly when your cranial and sacral nerves are controlling the system. Okay, so where is the ganglion in this system? Close to the spinal cord or farther away?
Farther away.
Farther away. So this has a long preganglionic neuron and a short postganglionic neuron. What is the neurotransmitter, the only one used by this system?
Acetylcholine.
Good. All right. How about questions on page 122? Okay. Before I talk to you about the chart on page 123, let me go back and do a backstory for you. Does this picture look familiar?
Yes.
Okay. Got an axon terminal. Okay. You've got a synaptic cleft there. That's that gap of space. And you've got a neighboring cell that has some receptors on there. These receptors are found on some types of channels. Like there's a little seat right there for some neurotransmitter. And there's a seat right there for some other neurotransmitter. So when we release neurotransmitters, the goal is to talk to the neighboring cell. So when we think back to our discussion in the previous chapter, what does an IPSP do to a cell?
Inhibits.
Good. What does an EPSP do to a cell?
It excites.
Good. Depolarizes. Good. Let's take that a step further. If you depolarize, what type of channel must you open?
Sodium.
Yeah. So that's EPSPs. They depolarize. Sodium rushes in when the neurotransmitter binds that receptor. Okay. So that promotes activity inside the neighboring cell. You told me that IPSPs put the cell to rest. So in that case, if a neurotransmitter binds, it may bind and open up potassium channels. What do potassium channels, when they leak, what does that do to your cell's charge?
Hyperpolarize,
makes it more negative, right? So that means it's going to stay at rest. So let's think big picture here. If I am under sympathetic control, which organs do I want to send EPSPs to?
Heart and lungs.
Heart and lungs. And I want to send IPSPs?
Digestive system.
Good. Let's flip-flop it. If I'm under parasympathetic control, I want to send EPSPs to?
Digestive system.
And IPSPs?
Heart and lungs.
Good. Okay, so the way you do this is by sending a neurotransmitter to the appropriate receptor. And those receptors sit on appropriate types of channels. And so that way we can drive what's happening inside those cells. So on your page there, we've got two types of receptors. We have adrenergic receptors and we have cholinergic receptors. Adrenergic sounds like adrenaline. Adrenaline is an alternate name for which neurotransmitter?
Epinephrine.
Good. So keep that in mind. Adrenergic and adrenaline are the same. This binds epinephrine and its buddy norepinephrine. Cholinergic receptors, choline is the hidden clue. That comes from acetylcholine. Okay. So we've got two types of receptors, ones that bind adrenaline, ones that bind acetylcholine. Okay, let's go back big picture one more time. If I'm under sympathetic control, I want to excite
heart and lungs.
Good. And which neurotransmitters work for the sympathetic nervous system?
Epinephrine
and norepinephrine, right. So I should expect to have alpha and beta adrenergic receptors on my heart and lungs. And if they're there, they're going to excite my heart and lungs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if acetylcholine works for your parasympathetic nervous system, then where do I find a lot of these nicotinic and muscarinic receptors?
Stomach,
yeah. It's alphabetical. A, B, M, and N. Okay, that's just a general rule of thumb here that you've got some alphas and betas working for the sympathetic nervous system in your heart and lungs. You've got some nicotinics and muscarinic receptors working for your parasympathetic nervous system in your digestive and urinary organs.
So is that why there is
heart rate? Mm-hmm. Yep. And we're going to talk about those because they're on the bottom of the page. Yeah. Okay, let me work you through that chart now that we've kind of had the basis laid down. Alpha receptors are adrenergic receptors, and they do work for the sympathetic nervous system. You'll notice that alpha receptors respond to norepinephrine and epinephrine. So as we expect, if you bind an alpha receptor, you increase the heart rate, and of course, that is due to the presence of epinephrine or norepinephrine there. If we do have some alpha receptors present on our digestive organs, it is their job to slow down digestive activity. So alpha receptors actually allow some calcium to enter into your cell. There is a type of medication called an alpha blocker, and alpha blockers would do what to your heart rate? Decrease it, slow it down. So an alpha blocker is, you know those plugs that they have for babies that they don't stick their fingers and stuff into outlets and they fit perfectly in the wall outlet? That's what a blocker drug does. It fits just perfectly into the alpha receptor. It blocks the neurotransmitter epinephrine or norepinephrine from binding to that receptor site.
So when it prevents norepinephrine and epinephrine from working, it's still being released.
It's still being released.
It's being blocked.
Right.
So does it get recycled like a pseudocoin?
It does. And because it's in your bloodstream, epinephrine and norepinephrine, we're going to learn on Bio-211, travel as hormones as well. And because it's in your bloodstream, a lot of it's going to be... Yeah, you indeed. The liver breaks them down. Some of it's reuptake, and then a lot of it's liver has to break down those hormones.
And then just excrete it.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that's important is because if I come in here and say, okay, put your notes and books away, we're having the test right now, you know, that happens. 30 minutes later, you still have epinephrine in your bloodstream. So it's not like it's reuptaked immediately. It's circulating for 30 minutes to an hour.
Okay, so I have a question.
Okay.
So you know when you get nervous or you get scared and sometimes you like grin?
Mm-hmm. That is psychosomatic. That is not parasympathetic, sympathetic. So if people pee on themselves or poop on themselves because they're so scared, it's actually control of the brain keeping those sphincters closed. So it's actually not these two systems that are at fault. Yeah. Good question there.
Alpha blockers would be for like tachycardia.
Yes, exactly, for tachycardia. Yep.
Can you actually be scared that they don't?
Yes. Yes.
So that's like a heart attack, or you just have a heart attack from fear, and
you have a heart attack from fear because you can starve oxygen from your heart, and then your heart has a heart attack.
Really scary.
I've heard of a case in North Carolina where somebody broke in a home, and the woman got so scared because the intruder was there when she was there that she had a heart attack from it. And yeah.
And so she
was just trying to get murder.
I don't know if they did for that particular case, but
wait, so did her body produce more alpha increase heart rate?
If you have more alpha receptors, I don't know that we actually make more receptors. It's just that you can have more neurotransmitter to bind the receptors you do have.
Question. How does the vagus happen to cause death? Like, in what way do you sever the nerve itself to cause death?
I'm not sure if it's severing it so much as stimulating it, because if you stimulate it, it decreases your heart rate and your blood pressure, indirectly your blood pressure, mm-hmm. to the point that you could bottom out and pass out. So if you overstimulate it, like people who have bowel movements and push really hard, pushing and coughing or holding your breath stimulates your vagus nerve, and that will cause heart rate to drop, and then blood pressure follows suit.
And you pass out. Because it's like visceral organ dysfunction or the death. That's basically the only disorders that they have. The vagus nerve.
Right. Yeah. Vasovagal syncope or fainting, and yeah, that's a big issue for that vagus nerve.
When my husband was in labor, right, once the pressure dropped, and mine had me throw up.
Vagus nerve problem. Lovely. Okay, how about other questions? I would probably ask you, like, what neurotransmitters increase sympathetic activity in your heart and lungs. I might ask you what types of receptors are adrenergic or cholinergic, something of that sort. I won't put that picture on there. I might just say to you which system has short or long. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about beta receptors for just a moment.
Is there a beta blocker drug?
There is a, you know, there's a beta blocker drug, there's an alpha blocker drug. Two different things. The goal is the same, which is to reduce tachycardia, but the way they work in the cell is a little bit different.
So how can you decipher which one you need, even though they do almost the same thing?
I take a beta blocker, and I take it because I have a condition called SVT, or supraventricular tachycardia, which is a fast heart rate. And for me, it's excess epinephrine and norepinephrine. So that makes my heart rate stay like at 100 beats per minute normally. And so for my condition, because it's epinephrine and norepinephrine, the beta blocker is a perfect fit. For somebody else, an alpha blocker may be better because they don't necessarily have the excess epinephrine and norepinephrine. It may be regulating that calcium in the cell that's the issue.
That's opening the channels and
letting too much. Because that reveals binding sites, and then myosin heads can form cross bridges. So that's more of an issue for somebody that takes calcium channel blockers or alpha blockers, which are two different drugs. Yeah.
When we get into nursing school, we're going to have to know exactly like what you just said, right?
This recording, come back and listen to it, yeah. We do all of this in 211 at least two or three times.
But you're supposed to bring everything up to the cellular level, aren't you? Just like all the medicines.
I think they do in that pharmacology class, yeah. Yeah, that's big stuff, yeah. So beta receptors are working for your sympathetic nervous system. Therefore, you have a lot of them on your heart and lungs, and there they will increase heart activity and blood pressure. Let's see, nicotinic receptors and muscarinic receptors primarily work for the parasympathetic nervous system. You have a lot of them here on your digestive and urinary organs to promote their activity, and of course they bind acetylcholine. You know, back when we studied the whole muscle and nerve impulse transmission process, I didn't mention to you, because it would have been one more thing to blow your mind, right, that the sodium channels had a nicotinic receptor sitting on them. But that was what we talked about way back when. Those nicotinic receptors were the ones that bound acetylcholine. The sodium channels open, sodium rushes in, depolarize the cell. Okay, so that encourages activity of your digestive organs. Muscarinic receptors and nicotinic receptors are actually named for where they were discovered. Muscarine is a mushroom, and nicotine, of course, comes from
cigarettes.
Yeah, so that's where those two were discovered. You'll notice that nicotinic receptors and muscarinic receptors both excite the digestive organs. That's, of course, because they work for which autonomic branch?
Parasympathetic,
right. This is a bouncing off point for great information. There are all kinds of medications out there on the market that manipulate these kinds of receptors. We did talk about alpha and beta blockers, but things like, Benadryl, for instance, is an anticholinergic blocker. Anticholinergic. So it means it works against the cholinergic receptors, yeah. They give medications during surgery to make people stop moving, and they may in fact be anticholinergic drugs. So this takes you into a whole new territory with drugs. So really cool stuff comes out of this conversation.
Okay. So you said Benadryl is an anticholinergic, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you take it for like allergies.
Make you go to sleep?
To prevent your body from...
The primary effect is antihistamine. Histamine is a neurotransmitter in your brain as well as an inflammatory agent. And so when you take antihistamines, it not only makes you more sleepy, but a process of that Benadryl is it's also anticholinergic.
So how do you make you more sleepy?
Well, it just blocks acetylcholine from those receptor sites too. Yeah.
Okay.
Big stuff. Just a little bit left for you guys. Page 124 is actually the last bit of content for this test. So most of today's discussion has been around motor control, and now we're going to switch gears and talk about sensory input for just a moment, and that will have taken us full circle with your nervous system. Are you guys taking Bio-211 this fall?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, that's good because you're not delaying getting into the next topic. We have the website where your lab images are housed that has course packs for fall semester. Give us about a week or two and we'll have Bio-211 loaded up there. And if you want to go ahead and grab your lab manual for lab, you can go ahead and pull that down and start getting ready for fall semester, you know, a little bit ahead of time. Where we go from here is in the endocrine system, which is our second communicating and controlling system. So we actually continue the conversation of this stuff as you start the next course. So this sensory info wraps up our information on the nervous system. At the top of your page there, you'll notice that nerve receptors are either classified as free, like you see in your skin, or as encapsulated nerve receptors, as you see in the eye. So free nerve endings are ones that have no covering, no connective tissue protection there. You know, if you cut yourself and you cut through nerve receptors in your skin, they may not grow back. If you burn or damage or promote scar tissue, these may not be able to repair themselves. And the eye is such an important sensory receptor. That's why it's protected by this strong, tough structure of the eyeball. So we can classify sensory receptors by their location, outside or extero, inside your body or intero, and joint receptors are proprioceptors. So where do you think temperature receptors fall into these three categories?
Extero.
Extero, good. How about a full bladder?
Intero.
Intero, good. And how about the presence of your legs bent in your chairs?
Proprio.
Yep, good. Proprioceptors, good. These sensory receptors can be classified by tonic or phasic. If they're tonic in nature, they are always on. What if they're phasic?
Only come on when needed.
Only come on when needed, right. Where do pain receptors fall between these two? Tonic, right. That's why pain is so irritating. It's to tell you about a problem, but you can't cut it off unless you use some kind of medication that blocks the reception of that pain. So yeah, pain receptors are considered tonic. Other things like temperature receptors are considered to be phasic.
No, I was just thinking.
Okay. They say that the first bite of a dessert is often the most flavorful bite. And, you know, they say that after that, the taste sensations become less intense. Interesting to note that because they are phasic receptors. So taste receptors actually cut off after you have the initial burst of flavor. And so that's why as you approach the end of the meal, the flavor sensations aren't quite as great as they were when you began the meal. Smells the same way. If you walk in the house and somebody's baking a cake and it smells delicious, give it 5 minutes, you won't smell a thing, right? Okay, so they're phasic as well. Exactly, yeah. People that live by the paper mill say, what paper mill, you know? Yeah, that's exactly it. Yep. Last, we classify receptors by what they receive, and we've got nocioreceptors that are pain receptors. Most parts of your body have these. What do thermoreceptors detect?
Temperature.
Good. We have mechanoreceptors in our skin that detect everything from touch and pressure and vibrations. Inside our bodies, we also have mechanoreceptors that detect barometer, which is pressure. So a full bladder or a full stomach or high blood pressure can set off a baroreceptor. Proprioceptors, what do they detect?
Joint position, movement, right.
And then chemoreceptors are going to be a big deal for us in Bio-211. They detect the chemistry of your bloodstream, how much oxygen you transport, CO2, or blood pH and hydrogen ions. So a lot of what we're doing now is going to carry over into Bio-211. So, you know, I hope that you review this a little bit between this and fall semester, because it's going to come back to play with us come fall term. So page 125 is just a practice page, and where we're headed in here, Monday after the test, we'll hit a little bit of eye and ear, not a whole lot of detail there, just enough to get you through the final exam on Wednesday of next week. Seriously, it is, we're being shut out of a cannon from here to the end.
Yep.
How about questions? We've got a little time left. How about questions for Monday?
No, I think I've asked them.
You've reached your limit.
I think I've reached my limit.
Well, we need to know the brain's vital cord properties on page 22.
I would not worry with those. I would not just do anything but read over them for your information, but they are not on the test. 118. They're an FYI page. Yeah.
Yeah.